This is Michael Matheson Miller, and you are listening to the Moral Imagination Podcast. Thank you for listening to the Moral Imagination Podcast. This episode is a talk that I gave at a conference in November of 2023, hosted by AMPHIL's Center for Civil Society. And the topic of the conference was the rise of the nuns, how declining religious affiliation is changing civil society in the United States. So my talk was the first of the day, and I set out really kind of a big picture of the decline of religious belief and also the rise of new religions, pantheism, with a focus on five false visions of the human person that contribute not only to despair and anxiety, but also to the decline of Christian belief and the rise of secularism and pantheism and new paganism. So this talk is really a thematic overview, and it's a distillation of two longer lectures that I give, one on five false anthropologies and how to think about that in terms of Christian anthropology, and then another on 10 reasons for unbelief and the decline of Christianity. But they are interrelated because I think one of the dominant forces for decline of unbelief are these five false anthropologies. So I want to thank you for listening, and thanks to all of you who have written reviews on Apple Podcasts. If you like the podcast and you have not written a review yet, please do go to Apple Podcasts and give it a 5-star review. It does help grow the podcast. Thanks to those of you who've supported me through Patreon. I appreciate it. It costs money to do the podcast, so every little bit does very much help. Please share the podcast with your family and friends. And also, you can go, as always, to themoralimagination.com for show notes and book links and other information. And please subscribe to my occasional newsletter, where I send out not only updates about the podcast, but essays that I've written or book reviews or things that I'm working on. And so you can subscribe at themoralimagination.com. And I'd like to thank especially AMPHIL and the Center for Civil Society for giving me the recording and allowing me to use this on the podcast.
Our conference today, as you know, is about what some have said to be the rise of the nuns. We will address how a decrease in faith and things like church attendance impact civil society. While it is undeniable that American society is becoming more secular, I would suggest that there is more beyond the headline numbers that we so often see. Although some studies indicate that faith and religion play less of a role in the lives of Americans today, nearly 3 out of 4 Americans still state a belief in God, which is higher than many countries, certainly in the Western world. And although overall attendance of services is down across religions, many communities of faith are thriving today. We see this in places of worship, schools, all types of nonprofits that serve civil society. And we will hear from experts who lead such organizations throughout the day. So while we live in challenging times, we have reasons to be optimistic. And I hope that this conference will be insightful for all of you, and I trust that the connections made and the knowledge shared will help us all do better as we move forward. As Tocqueville once said, "In America, religion is the road to knowledge, and the observance of the divine laws leads man to civil freedom." We have today an outstanding lineup of speakers and panelists, but what makes our Givers, Doers, and Thinkers conference truly special is that virtually anyone here today could easily be a speaker or a panelist based on your credentials, your experience, and your accomplishments. So again, this is a room full of intelligent people with a passion for our nation and civil society. And thank you so much for traveling and being with us here today. We will begin by hearing from one of our featured speakers, Michael Matheson Miller. Michael is a senior research fellow and chief of strategic initiatives at the Acton Institute. He is the director of the Center for Social Flourishing and the Poverty Cure Initiative, which seek to promote access to the institutions of justice and local entrepreneurial solutions to poverty in both the United States and the developing world. Michael is the director and producer of the award-winning documentary Poverty, Inc., and several video series, including Poverty Cure, The Good Society, and The Gospel of Work. He is the host of the Moral Imagination podcast and is the author of Digital Contagion, 10 Steps to Protect Your Family and Business from Data Intrusion and Surveillance Capitalism, and the book Excluded, How the Poverty Industry Excludes the Poor from Justice and Prosperity, forthcoming next year. Michael is also a distinguished fellow at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America and serves on the boards of the Sacred Heart Classical Academy and the Hildebrand Project. Michael, thank you for being with us today.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted to be here and honored to be participating in this event. It's always difficult to speak, but especially when you're told this is a room full of highly intelligent, competent people that just kind of like raises the level a little bit, but I'm delighted to be here. So I'm going to talk today about anthropologies of unbelief, that is, these philosophies of the person that shape our unbelief or that influence unbelief in the United States, especially today, but across the world. Now, there are multiple causes of unbelief, and many of them are interrelated, so it can be hard to tell whether something's a cause or a consequence. So, for example, the rise of ideology, is this a result of unbelief? As Chesterton says, when you stop believing in God, you tend to believe in anything. But it's also a cause of unbelief, because the ideology pulls us away, say, from Christian faith. Now, again, atheism and agnosticism are also nothing new. I mean, this is a perennial challenge. We're tempted by many things. Our moral life is not in consonance with the gospel and the teachings of the commandments of God. And so that kind of pulls us away. Or there's just the temptations to despair. The problem of evil is still a problem for many people. And especially in our scientific world, it's hard to understand, like, does God really there? But right now, we've also seen a radical increase in unbelief. And so I want to speak a little bit about those things today. So what I'd like to do in this talk is first go through just some, what I think are some of the big picture influences on the rise of unbelief. These are all very complex, and I'm going to do them quickly, which means I won't do justice to them, but I want to at least put them out there. And I know some of the speakers here will be addressing them in more detail. Second, I want to focus then on five anthropological viewpoints, that is philosophies of the person, that are dominant and that shape the way we engage the world and I think have a profound impact on the loss of faith. And then finally, suggest that one of the things we have to do is repropose a deep Christian vision of the human person, that being is good, that we're made in the image of God, and that we are valued as a response to what I would say these anthropologies are often anthropologies of either despair or utopianism, but ultimately at the bottom, they're nihilism or utopianism. And we have to propose an alternative to that. So let me go through part one then. This is the big picture again. These are some of the influences I think you probably have a lot more to add to this. I would say the first and foremost, the big influence on the decline of belief in the United States is the breakdown of the family and the decline of fatherhood participation. I think this is quite clear from the data. When fathers are involved in family life and are practicing their religion, the retention rate, if you want to call it that, of people keeping in their faith is very, very high. So I think it's important sociologically, but I also think it's important theologically, right? So the Trinity is a family. John Paul II says, God is not a solitude. And so this idea of family life, of being united as the family breaks down, our inability to understand God or relate to God, I think, increases. And it's an existential issue for us. Mary Eberstadt has written, of course, very well on this. If you haven't read her books, How the West Lost God or Primal Screams, I highly recommend those. And I think she's speaking here later today. So the second and then related cause is the sexual revolution. Augusto Del Noce, who's an Italian philosopher, argued that the sexual revolution is actually the extension of Marxism. And if we think about everybody from Marx, Engels, Robert Owen, Antonio Gramsci, the Fabians, Adorno, Marcuse, you name it, they see three obstacles to socialist reform. And those three obstacles are religion, obviously, private property, and this present form of marriage. And so why is that? Because here's a place where, say, Catholic social teaching and Christian understanding, like traditional Jewish Christian understandings, that there's a mutually reinforcing relationship between family, private property, and religion. Because it's in the family, with private property that gives them space to live out their freedom and their responsibilities, that religion and culture, cultus, is passed down. And so both Marxists and Christians realize if you go after those three things, you will undermine religious belief. And we've seen that over and over again. So the sexual revolution, I think, also creates deep disorientation of the person, of the family, of who we are, and deep relationships between men and women. And this too creates this instability related to, as I said, the family, that become obstacles to belief. The third, I would say, again related, these first three are very related, is the problem of feminism. Carrie Grass, in her excellent book, The End of Woman, talks about how the call to smash the patriarchy is part of what's happening is a portrayal of man and God, that is males and God, as sources of unjust civilization. And there's actually, it's even like quite striking that there's some of the writers do a parallel and they say, well, on one side you have Satan and woman and the other side, man and God. And so in order to free the woman, we have to crush the patriarchy and crush God. And so we see a rejection of motherhood, a rejection of fertility, of the nurturing elements. These two, again, go back. They're all interrelated, I think. You see also an encouraging of the occult. As Carrie Grass notes, there are now more Wicca adherents than there are PCUSA Presbyterians in the United States. And so ultimately, this feminism and the sexual revolution leads to what the great German-Canadian psychiatrist Carl Stern calls a flight from woman, a rejection of femininity, a rejection of fecundity, a rejection of really of the earth. And you can see this, of course, manifesting, which is very complex, in the transgender movement, which is both girls leaving, trying to get rid of their femininity and trying to make themselves into men, but also men, often hyper-technical men, in a sense, appropriating woman to themselves. So instead of being in a relationship with woman where the two become one, the woman is erased and the man appropriates the woman as a commodity. So the fourth, I would say, is you can see in the writings of the great Alexis de Tocqueville. I could never be at a conference on civil society and not mention Tocqueville, but this is not forced, I promise. Tocqueville, as you know, worried that democratic life, marked by individualism and egalitarianism, would lead to the rise of the most dominant religion. And he thought that the most dominant religion would be pantheism. Our desire for equality would be so strong that we don't even want a difference between God and man. And this, of course, is very complex, but you can see right here the idea that Christianity has to be rejected because it's hierarchical. It's opposed in some ways to equality, even though we know that it's the Jewish and Christian traditions that brought the idea of the dignity and equality of man, that Tocqueville says equality becomes a force that runs over everything in its way. So it even overruns its own sources. And then, of course, we can also see the rise of the environmental movement, which is connected to pantheism. And so Christianity here, too, is an obstacle to environment. It's a force for dominion and destruction over the earth. Whether that's true or not is a different question. But that's, I think, part of the rise of unbelief. The fifth is technology and the technological society. And I think we can think about technology in two ways. One is just the maybe most obvious is the constant distraction and entertainment, right? The constant distraction and entertainment. There's no time for silence. There's no need or really even ability to wrestle with existential angst. So if you're a young person and you're struggling with the complexities and the vicissitudes of life, you don't have quiet. You can just medicate yourself, as it were, by scrolling, by looking at Netflix, by scrolling the phone, by constantly being entertained. And in addition to that, the content is often hostile to faith. So if you think about Facebook or Twitter or TikTok, there's actual hostile content to faith. And so we have propaganda and what Jaron Lanier has called behavior modification. So Lanier, if you don't know who he is one of the founders of virtual reality. He's secular, he's not a believer, but he's very worried. He wrote a book called 10 Reasons or Arguments to Delete Your Social Media Accounts Right Away. And he says that this is a quote, we are being tracked and measured constantly and receiving engineered feedback all the time. We're being hypnotized little by little by technicians we can't see for purposes we do not know. We are all lab animals now, end quote. Now, this is a technologist who has been involved in Silicon Valley. He sold the company to Google. This is not a Luddite, okay? And he's saying we have to be very, very careful because we don't realize the behavior modification that's taking place. And I think it's important to remember here something that's a little abstract, but I think it's very important. Code is not neutral, okay? Code is not neutral. If I had a PowerPoint, by the way, which tends to corrupt, and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely. I've actually shown this before in a PowerPoint. I say, okay, if I showed you a picture of Brasilia and then Florence, architecture is code. Architecture shapes the way we experience the world. If I showed you a picture of the Los Angeles Catholic Cathedral and then Notre Dame in Paris, not the real Notre Dame. Okay. I went there. It's a great place to become a Protestant. Okay. So code shapes us, and so too does digital code. Right? And so many of the large tech companies are built upon foundations that, and they promote atheism, materialism, and transhumanism. So the Google founders, for example, are adherents of the Burning Man principles. You can see it. They hang it up in their offices. So this is, I think, another thing that's taking place. I'm not saying we shouldn't use technology. I'm saying that technology does impact us more. It's kind of like the child who says, well, I listen to the music, but I don't listen to the lyrics. The lyrics are almost the least destructive part. All right. So the second part then of how a technological society that has profound impact is the influence of what you could call scientism, right? Or empiricist rationality. And this is the idea that you're all familiar with, that the only things that are reasonable are those things which we can empirically verify. All right? If you can't measure it and empirically verify it, it's outside the realm of reason. Now, this is a problem that is deeply problematic on many ways. Number one, it's incoherent on its own terms, right? Because you can't empirically verify that claim, right? So it's an incoherent position. But what's most important for the belief question is it takes the fundamental human questions in our life, religion, belief, God, the afterlife, love, beauty, hope, compassion, forgiveness, mercy, justice, substantial truth claims, and it relegates them all outside the realm of reason. So all we have are this kind of like empiricist elements and then kind of feelings. And so the religious dimension is in many ways excluded. Augusto Del Noce says, before there's an attack on faith, there's an attack on the religious dimension, right? It's just not relevant. It's not important in our scientific world. It doesn't matter. And so this severs the relationship between reason and our affective sphere, our emotional life. So we don't have a framework of how to think about our emotions or our deepest experiences. And our feelings really only become valuable insofar as they can be used or commodified by marketers or social engineers. And this diminishes the person. It's the abolition of man. So it also leads to irrational rationalism, if you want to call it that, to scientism, right? And this is why we see decreasing belief in God and increasing belief in aliens and the multiverse. And this is real. I mean, people believe in the multiverse, right? It's not just in the Marvel. They actually believe it. So it also believes in this techno-utopian belief that there's a technical solution to the problems of evil, sin, suffering, and death. So I don't need God, right? A friend of mine, Rabbi Mitch Rockland, says, if there's no God, there's no covenant. And if there's no covenant, then man is left alone. And if man's left alone, then we have to solve the problem ourselves. And this techno-utopianism, man is alone. As John Paul says, is man lonely or is he alone? And man feels alone. So this defense of reason, I would argue, is not just an academic discussion. I know it's very intellectual, but Benedict XVI writes about this. The defense of reason is the defense of the human being. The sixth, I think, big picture is just the rise of humanitarianism, which is related. What matters is the world's projects, feeding the hungry, curing the sick, ending poverty, ending discrimination. So why do we need a spiritual dimension? I can be a good person without Christianity. Christianity is just kind of judgmental and mean and uncaring, and I can care for people without Christianity. Because humanitarianism, as we know, is a secular version of Christian love that focuses on providing comfort. But And these, if you like Benedict XVI in his great book, Jesus of Nazareth, Volume 1, actually talks about this in the Temptations of Christ. This is the temptation. Just feed the hungry. Let the church be an NGO. And then the seventh and final one before I get to the philosophy of the person is, I think, assimilation by the church and failure to catechize. So very few things stand out. Our liturgy lacks sacred character. We don't practice the non-linguistic catechesis of liturgy, which teaches us things outside of the verbal. Our music is pretty banal. I mean, in Protestant churches, at least you get rock music. In Catholic churches, I can't even talk about it. Okay. It's all more or less a lame version of the world. And religion, too, focuses on projects of the world, but in really a clunkier, more unsophisticated way, right? And then many Christian denominations have assimilated. They have the same positions on, say, sexual issues, contraception, vasectomies, divorce. Well, I know this is a hard thing to say, but think about it. If you're already having vasectomies, well, what's the big shift to transgender? I mean, you're already using technology to manipulate in a way that people just don't see it. Like, I don't get it. You're just like, what's the problem, right? And so I think this is a problem. You combine that with the sexual abuse scandals, and there's just a sense that I have no place for religion. And this failure to catechize is not just with children, but with adults, and not just intellectually, but in community, bringing people in. We have no real experience of a Christian community. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, when people are leaving Christianity, do they even know what they're leaving? There's almost, and I know I'm being a bit harsh, okay, because there are many examples. Don't get me wrong. I agree with Jonathan. There are tons of positive things. Okay, I kind of joked. I went to Notre Dame. It's a good place to become Protestant, which I kind of did. I came back into the Catholic Church. Notre Dame now is in some ways worse, but also 10 times better. Like the opportunities that are there now for a child. Like I would say to my older children, okay, you could go to Notre Dame if you're ready. I wouldn't have said that when I was there. Absolutely not. So I don't want to say that there's no things, but I'm saying these are part of the views. So the question, though, is when young Christians get out of their homes, they have almost no intellectual rigor. So they get plucked out by ideology, by atheism, like kind of Sam Harris charlatan types who are convincing you that there's no free will. Did you see, what's his name, Robert Sapolsky? He just concluded there's no free will. I love how he concluded it. I've come to a decision. Okay. I mean, in many ways, this is not serious stuff, but regular Christians just don't know how to answer it. All right. And then this leads me to my main part of my talk, that we have these huge anthropological forces coming at us. So I've said a lot of things in big picture, but I think these are some of the forces that are coming around us that we need to pay attention to. But I would say one of the things that I want to focus on is the anthropological, the views of the person that dominate our contemporary life. So I would argue that in many ways, we are in an anthropological struggle, and that many of the social, political debates are actually debates about the person. And so let me go through five of them. So the first big kind of idea that's around, I mean, they're not in any particular order, by the way. The first one I'll deal with is what I'd call plastic anthropology. So this is very influential and increasingly so. I think in maybe philosophical terms, we could call it a new ontology of the person. It's a new kind of metaphysics of the person that's plastic. And it has a lot of effect. It kind of interrelates with transhumanism, which I'll discuss. So one way to understand plastic anthropology is this, and I'm sorry I'm making you do a little bit of philosophy at 8 o'clock in the morning, but it's in the Eastern time. It's already almost noon. So in an Aristotelian or Thomistic vision of the person, human beings have an essence. We're a certain kind of thing. We're hylomorphic, embodied, embedded persons with a specific nature. We're a kind of being. Okay? Now, each of us is unique and unrepeatable. Right? Each of us is an individual with freedom. But we have freedom within an essence. With plastic anthropology, right, the essence is changed. Okay? It's inverted. So you don't start with an essence, you start with raw existence. And then you can choose yourself. So LGBTQA+, whatever it is, you choose yourself, and then the plastic hardens, and that's who you are. So it's this radical self-creation that combines, it's like an inverted Thomism. Okay? And so We're malleable and plastic based on our will, our volition. Okay, so for example, so I'm Catholic, so I'll give this example. You would say that a man struggles with homosexual attraction. The new ontology would say the man is homosexual. With transgenderism, if a man identifies as a woman, he is a woman, right? And society is required to treat him as such. So that dignity, as you know, becomes a weapon against religious liberty. Now, these are very complex issues, okay, ladies and gentlemen. And people are suffering, as we know. They are victims of the sexual revolution. Many of them have experienced sexual abuse. But they're also victims of false anthropologies and the failure of adults to help vulnerable people navigate through difficult times because we don't want to tell them the truth. The reduction, I would say, of a person's identity, their sexual predilection, I would argue, is an act of injustice. It often acquits an abuser that's behind the scenes, right? And it identifies people with a struggle they have. We would never say Bill Clinton is a promiscuous. Okay, I am not that, okay? We wouldn't say that, right? We would never say to a young girl who has struggling with anorexia, that's who you are. Just starve yourself until you die, okay? But we do this in this new plastic anthropology, and it's an act of injustice against the vulnerable. And it's also important to remember, as C.S. Lewis said, man's power over nature is always some men's power over other men. So if they can choose their identity, the powerful can also shape their other people's identity. So the second anthropology, which is related, is what's called transhumanism or post-humanism. Now, this is a big deal. The further you get out west towards Silicon Valley, the bigger it is. And this is the idea that we're going to combine biology and technology to create a more advanced human being, a cyborg. Now, if some of you are listening, you think, okay, this is crazy. There are billions and billions and billions of dollars going into this every year, okay? So transhumanism believes that as a human species, we're in an evolutionary move, because remember, it's materialist. And so at this point, we're just at a one early stage of our evolution. And we're going to now use technology to go to the next stage of our evolution. So I think it's Marvin Minsky at MIT that said, well, robots inherit the earth. And he said, yes, they will be our children, right? And so this, it's this idea that, and this is a quote, we're going to rewrite our bug-ridden genetic code and become godlike. Only high-tech solutions can ever eradicate suffering from the world, end quote. Right, that's from a well-known transhumanist. So transhumanism then extends beyond the restoration of health to this radical transformation. And as you know, it's connected to eugenics. Well, we already practice sex selection and genetic testing for children with Down syndrome, and this is just the beginning. I have a longer talk, which I won't bore you with, but as you probably know, in 2018, a Chinese scientist, He Jingkui, edited the genes of two twin embryo girls to make them resistant to HIV. These girls are born, they're alive. And I want to ask you a dark question. If you can take girls in embryo and make them resistant to HIV, why don't we make them resistant to gonorrhea and syphilis? And why don't we sterilize them? And now we have replicants. Now we have sex slaves, engineered beings. If you think this is not in the works, you're wrong. This stuff is in the works. It's dark. And this is this transhumanist idea. And we already see this with the idea of designer babies, right? That you can pick the kind of child you want. And so this is a commodification of the person, which I'll talk about in more detail in a second. But it's very harmful to the soul. Right? And it's really a kind of a utopian nihilism. There's also, of course, aspirational transhumanism, this we're going to upload ourselves to the internet. I think that's not going to work because it doesn't take our embodied, embedded nature seriously. But there's billions of dollars going into it. And I think it's also important to mention just briefly that transgenderism is also a subset of transhumanism. It's not just its own thing, because think about what there's actually books about from transhumanism, transgenderism. It's using biology to create a new kind of person, right? So that's where plastic anthropology and transhumanism align. And so I think the key thing is that this is the new Tower of Babel. The new Tower of Babel is not the big, you know, thousand-year Reich. The new Tower of Babel is man himself. The third And I think also it's important, I said this before, we're already acclimated to this because we're constantly using birth control and vasectomies and a host of other things that we do, which are different from restoration. They're like a manipulation. All right, so the third one that's dominant is pretty well obvious. It's human being as a cog. And this is the human being is to be used for productivity in service of the state or the company or the economy. And we see this, of course, in extreme forms in the gulag, labor camps, or Chinese capitalism, where the individual exists solely for the collective or for the project. But we also see it in less extreme forms, in industrial factory farms. We see it in kind of the World Economic Forum ethos that you're not going to own property and everyone's going to be kind of managed, right? We see this in the way we deal with poverty in the developing world. You know, that human beings are just a problem to be solved. They're just objects of our charity that we can manipulate. Instead of being protagonists of their own stories of development, they're just cogs in our machine. The fourth one is human beings as a scourge. And this is that human beings are a problem for the planet. They're a problem for the environment. And we see this, of course, in the extreme forms in zero growth movements or deep ecology. But really, it's everywhere. It's part of our work. When I do a PowerPoint, I show a picture of Greta Thunberg. Is that her name? Greta Thunberg. And it's interesting because people kind of laugh when I put her up because she's like, you know, very upset. But, you know, we shouldn't laugh at her. Me too, okay? Because this poor little girl has been completely propagandized that somehow she is a problem, that human beings are a problem for the world. Young ladies are sterilizing themselves so they can save the climate. I mean, they're destroying their future hope as a mother so they can save the climate. Because they're taught that you are a problem in this world. And this, as you see, is connected to Tocqueville's concept of pantheism, right? This also, it's just a deep problem, the rise of paganism, and it breeds nihilism, and I think profoundly influences unbelief. And so Christianity, of course, in this world, is a source of dominion and destruction. So we can't have that. And then the fifth and final one is really a capitulation of them all. And I would say that the human being is seen as a commodity. One of the best ways to understand this is, again, through this philosopher I like, Augusto Del Noce. He's Italian, died in 1989. And he came up with this concept called the pure bourgeois. Okay, the pure bourgeois. And he said that what happened was, in the 20th century, we began to see the Marxification of capitalism, right? In the 50s, everybody was like, we're going to defeat the Soviet Union based on, you know, our Christian principles. It became, we're going to defeat, in the 50s and 60s, we're going to defeat the Soviet Union based on productivity, liberation, and sexual liberation, which are Marxist values. So you have this idea, right? So when the Berlin Wall fell, we're like, oh, capitalism won the day. But it was actually a pure bourgeois capitalism. Right? And so what happens is, as Del Noce points out, he said you had the hippies, okay? And the hippies were like, you know, they rejected technology, they rejected tradition and family, and they were waiting for the age of Aquarius. And when the age of Aquarius did not arrive, Del Noce says, the hippie continued to reject tradition, but he completely embraced technology and trade and became a yuppie. The pure bourgeois, happiness can be acquired. There's nothing outside, nothing transcendent. Everything is imminent. Happiness can be purchased, and every single thing becomes an object of trade. Our bodies, our wombs, our sperm, our eggs, children, everybody is an object of trade. And he actually points this out. He says, nudity is like an advertisement. He thinks this is deeply connected to modesty. And so what you have is a huge problem with modesty, right? And we think of it as, oh, being prudish. But Del Noce is pointing out it's because people see themselves as commodities. It's a commodification of the human being. So all of these things lead to not just euthanasia, abortion, and suicide, but the degrading of mothers, right? The degrading of children, and everything that's organic must be sterilized. And so I would say this idea of commodification, this is not an economic problem. This is a deep philosophical problem that is, I think, weighing heavy on the hearts of people. So let me conclude this saying. How do we address these questions? Now, there's so many things I just laid out. I mean, it's almost the time of despair. But I think there's many things we can do. But the thing I want to focus on is that we have to repropose the good news, the evangelium of the human person. You know, if you look back into the history, what happened, what was one of the striking elements? Henri de Lubac talks about this in his book, The Drama of Atheistic Humanism. He said, the message that human beings were created in the image of God, that we had agency. We weren't dominated by fate. We weren't dominated by outside forces, but we were agents. We were created by God to be in charge of ourselves and given ourselves as a gift. This transformed life and civilization. And then later it became seen as a yoke. And I think we have to repropose the gospel. So I would say we have to, one, reaffirm and continually reiterate the fact that being is good. The world is good. The world is intelligible. And here we see the Hebrew Bible and the Jewish and Catholic traditions stand in contrast with Marxism, nihilism, paganism, pantheism. It says the world is good, as Joseph Ratzinger points out in a wonderful set of homilies from the 1980s. He said, the world is not made out of dragon's blood. It's not something we have to escape from, right? Affirming the goodness of being and the goodness of human life creates the grounds for gratitude, reverence, and hope, and the goodness of the body. Our bodies are not an accident. It's not something to escape from. So that's the first. Second, we have to affirm that each human person is a subject and not an object to be manipulated, modified, or socially engineered. Each person is valued not because they're productive. Of course we're supposed to be productive. The Bible says, go complete creation. But we're not valued simply for our productivity. We are willed for our own sake. And in this, you see some of the heroic parents who have children who have disabilities, who care for them and are a witness, right, to the dignity of each human person. The third, we have to defend reason and defend freedom. We have to affirm that the human being is reasonable, and our reason extends not just to the empirical, but to love, beauty, truth, and goodness. Love is not a blind force. It's a reasonable emotion, to use the words of Lewis. Our freedom is real. Of course we're influenced by our environment. Of course we're influenced by our biology and our neurobiology, all right? Why? We're made out of the dust of the earth. You know, have you ever heard people say, well, you know, human beings share like 96% of DNA with a chimpanzee. I'm like, yes, we share 60% with a banana. Of course, we're made out of the dust of the earth. How we eat, if you have a high sugar breakfast, it's going to affect your metabolic health. And as Chris Palmer has shown in his new book, Brain Energy, which I highly recommend, there's a connection between mental health and metabolic health. I told Chris, this is Christian anthropology. He doesn't even know it. Okay? And so we have to stress our freedom. The idea of freedom is either that we're totally determined or that our freedom is just this radical exercise of the will. Okay? But again, as Ratzinger points out, an irrational will is not a free will. If I start banging my head on this podium and blood shoots out over you, no one in the room is going to say, wow, Michael is so free. It's amazing. I want to be free like that. No, you'd think I was crazy. So reason and freedom have a purpose, and that purpose is for love and for worship and sacrifice. And people don't know this. So we have to re-engage these things. We have to stress our social nature, that we're neither radical individuals, nor do we simply exist for the collective. And again, we have to affirm the goodness of our bodies, that our bodies are not accidents. We don't drive around in our body like we drive around in a car. We're embodied, embedded persons. And in the Christian tradition, the Jewish tradition, what happens at the end? You get your body back. Because your body's not an accident. As St. Thomas Aquinas says, I'm not my soul. Right? We are not accidental, our bodies. And so I would say in the face, the good news is, all the anthropologies that are dominant are incoherent. They don't match with our lived experience. Their philosophies of nihilism, false utopianism, which is always false, I guess that's redundant, and despair. And the Christian vision of the human person is one of coherence, of alignment with our lived experience of as persons. It helps us address the question of love and beauty and friendship. Chemical, like, oh, your love is just a chemical reaction. One time I went home to my wife, I said, my chemicals are super attracted to your chemicals. And so she said, don't ever give me flowers again. That's all I need to hear. Okay. So Christians are sent out into the world with no intellectual or communal rigor. And of course, we need, don't get me wrong, this is not intellectual. You need prayer. You need deep relationship with Jesus Christ, right? You need friendship with God. You need to be in community. You need to feel like you're supported. You need to have all these different connections. This is not a, we're not just kind of radical individuals moving around. All of this has to be done within a context of community and love. But the reality is, our vision of the human person is, as I said, the most coherent, the most attractive, and it absolutely transformed the world. And it can do so again. The last two decades, we have seen not only a decline in religious belief, we've seen a decrease in happiness, we've seen increases in anxiety, loneliness, depression, and suicide. We've seen family breakdown, drug use, a huge set of problems. Now it's correlated, okay, but I think there's more than correlation going on. Carrie Grass, in her book, The End of Woman, writes, women are not happier, they're just more medicated. And I think this is a problem for all of us. This is a struggle. So Benedict XVI says, we're living in alienation, in the salt waters of suffering and death, in a sea of darkness without light. So we must bring men and women out of the sea into the light of God. He says, there's nothing more beautiful than to be surprised by the gospel, by the encounter with Christ. And as we saw, this Christian vision of the human person that's central in the Hebrew Bible and the books of the New Testament, amazed and transformed the world. It was radical. And as John Paul II says, this amazement determines the church's mission in the world, and perhaps so even in the modern world. And so the key element of the Christian vision of the human person is ultimately that each person is willed and loved for their own sake. But you can't understand this if you don't have a family. You can't understand this if you're excluded and you're a radical individual. You can't understand this if you're being abused. You can't understand this if you're in this solitude. So we have to have community. And in that, then we affirm the goodness of each being. And the wonderful philosopher Joseph Pieper says, to say I love you, right, is to seek the good of the other and to say it is good that you are. And that's the message that we have to give every single person so that they can come back to the church, because it is good indeed that you are. Thank you for your time.